Good morning. A couple of months ago, can you hear me back there? Is that loud enough? Good. A couple of months ago, a group of us went over to the Minneapolis Institute of Arts, to the Art Institute, for a tour of the Buddhist art. And if you haven't been over there, you should really go. They have amazing statues and other Buddhist artifacts over there. But we went over for a tour, and in one of the side rooms, there was a pen and ink drawing of an old friend, and I thought I'd talk about him today. His name is Bird's Nest Roshi. There's a famous story about him that describes an encounter between him and another person. And the story has two characters. First one is Bird's Nest Roshi himself. He was a Tang Dynasty era Chinese Zen master. And his name literally means nest. And he was called that because he liked to meditate in a tree. Some versions of the story say that he lived in the tree and that it hung over a cliff that had a really steep drop. So if he wasn't mindful, he would fall to his death. So he had to have great concentration. But that's only in some of the stories, so I won't vouch for that one. And the other person in the story is a government official named Bai Jue, who was also a renowned poet. Dogen Zenji, the founder of our school of Buddhism in Japan, was a big fan of his poetry. So Bai Jue had a number of different government positions. He worked his way up three different times to be a governor of one of the provinces. But a few times he did things or said things that put him out of favor. And so he was exiled a couple of times. He was shuffled around from one position to another. And so he had mostly a good but kind of a rocky career. So Bird's Nest Roshi lived in this tree, or at least practiced in this tree. And so, you know, he was maybe a little bit eccentric, we might say. And when I was thinking about him over the last couple of weeks, it occurred to me that it's been over half a century since I had climbed a tree. It's been in 1961 was the last time I climbed a tree. So I thought, well, you know, it's part of my preparation. I could put down the Google and go climbing a tree. And we have a big red oak on the meditation path back there that's actually perfect. It has a couple of low branches, so I thought it was about my speed. So last Monday night after sewing, I decided I was going to go climb that tree, and Cindy stayed with me because she said I was going to need somebody to dial 911 after I fell out of the tree and broke something. But it turned out that wasn't needed, but it wasn't a very comfortable seat up there. And one thing I did learn was, you know, wear sneakers, not sandals, when you climb a tree. It wasn't very comfortable. I think Bird's Nest Roshi must have had a little platform or some different kind of tree or something. So I decided that when I'm old and eccentric, it's going to have to manifest in some other way than climbing a tree. But Bird's Nest Roshi liked to sit up in his trees. And one day the government official happened to be in the area. He's walking by. He sees Bird's Nest up in the tree. And he says, "That's a very precarious seat you have up there." And Bird's Nest Roshi shot back, said, "Well, yours is more precarious than mine." And that kind of took the government official by surprise. He was kind of taken aback and didn't have a response to that. So very kindly, Bird's Nest added, "When passions burn and the mind is unsteady, this is the greatest danger. And the birds, the government official then asked, what's your dharma? Meaning, what do you teach? What do you teach? And Bird's Nest Roshi recited a verse from the Dhammapada that's on your bulletin that says, don't do evil, always do good and purify the mind. This is what all the Buddhas taught. Well, the government official was not impressed by that. And he said, any child of three knows that. And Bird's Nest Roshi replied again in a very compassionate way. He said, any child of three may know that, but even an 80-year-old finds it difficult to put into practice. So that's the story. So let's unpack it a little bit. So the government official says, you've got a pretty precarious seat right there. And, you know, maybe he's concerned for Bird's Nest safety, you know, or maybe he's just surprised by seeing this old guy sitting in a tree and he just blurts it out. But either, oh my goodness, there's a squirrel back there on the tree in the window. Face down, tail up. Looks pretty precarious to me. So one of Buddha's rules for the monastic community was not to indulge in idle chatter. And I'd always sort of thought, you know, what's wrong with idle chatter? It's sort of a social lubricant. Nothing wrong with idle chatter. I'm guilty of it most of the time. But I think that what the government official was saying was, it sounded kind of negative, you know, it was kind of challenging, and I think the tone of it was almost rude. And at the very least, it's not a very promising conversation starter. But Bird's Nest Roshi just jumps right in and says, no, yours is a precarious life. And that sort of stops the government official, and now he's paying attention. You know, I think it would stop any of us. You know, we don't ordinarily think of our lives as being precarious. We think, you know, I've got this under control. I can, you know, things are going good. I can take care of things. But the government official has had this kind of up and down life, and, you know, he might have, who knows, he might have been on his way into one of his exile positions when he ran into Bird's Nest. So he's just kind of standing there with his mouth open, is the way I imagine it, and then that's when Bird's Nest Roshi adds the bit about when passions burn and the mind is unsteady. This is the greatest danger. So, you know, the official had some history with this. And one time there was a change in the leadership of the country. I don't remember if the emperor died or what, but one leader ended his reign, and then this sort of strongman guy came in, and the government official had written a poem commemorating the former leader and criticizing the incoming guy. And that was the reason he was exiled once. I take some comfort in knowing nothing like that would ever happen now. But that's what happened to him. So he wrote this poem. It's called On Being Removed from Sunyang and Sent to Chungchou, which was a remote place in the mountains of the Sichuan province. So he was sent there, and here's what he had to say in his poem. Before this, when I was stationed at Sunyang, already I regretted the fewness of friends and guests. Suddenly, bearing a stricken heart, I left the gates with nothing to comfort me. So this is when he had been exiled. Excuse me. In a bottomless gorge, flanked by precipitous mountains, 5 months on the end of the passage of boats is stopped. 5 months on end, the passage of boats is stopped by the piled billows that toss and leap like colts. The inhabitants here are like animals. I cleaned up his language there. He said something way worse. The inhabitants here are like animals. Fierce and lusty, they fill the mountains and prairies. Among such as these, I cannot hope for friends, and am pleased with anyone who is even remotely like me. So you can imagine, you know, he's been exiled. He's in this place surrounded by people that he is not crazy about. You can imagine how his passions are burning. His mind is unstable. So he gets what Bird's Nest has just said to him. You know, he's had some reversals in his career, and he hasn't responded very well to them. So he thinks, you know, maybe I can learn something from this guy. So, you know, he asked him, what do you have to teach? What do you teach? And when Bird's Nest tells him, you know, don't do evil, do good, and purify the mind, that wasn't at all what he was expecting. Does anybody recognize that, besides being a verse from the Dhammapada, don't do evil, do good, and purify the mind? Does that ring a bell? It's the three pure precepts. We recite them during ordinations and Zen initiations and some other ceremonies just before the 10 prohibitory precepts. So the 10 precepts are like, you know, don't kill, don't steal, don't lie, don't intoxicate yourself, don't be greedy, don't misbehave sexually, you know, don't slander other people. And the three pure precepts are more like sort of an overarching view of things. And they can seem pretty obvious. Don't do bad things, do good things. The third one, purify your mind, is the Theravadin, the early Buddhist version of it. Dogen says, clarify your mind. And the translation that you see a lot these days will go something like, act always with others in mind. It's the Bodhisattva ideal. You know, and any child of three knows that. Few 80-year-olds can actually do it. And I think this is everybody's issue. This is everybody's issue. Usually we know right from wrong, and yet we mess up over and over again. You notice he doesn't say don't be evil. He says don't do evil. From a Buddhist perspective, there isn't some sort of outside force in the universe called evil. You know, evil isn't out there somewhere waiting, just waiting to enter us when we're not looking. There aren't bad people. They're just bad or ill thought out or unskillful or maybe deluded actions. You know, maybe we get hung up on that word evil. I used to go to a church where the priest would pronounce it evil. Evil. And it turned out my brother went to seminary with that guy, and I asked him about it once, and he said, well, he's kind of old school. But I liked it. But it's a word we can get kind of hung up with, and so maybe it helps to say, as Dogen does in the second quotation, not doing wrong action. Dogen actually wrote a fascicle one of the fascicles in the Shobo Genzo is called Not Doing Wrong Action. And, you know, Dogen always puts his little twist on things. And although the Dhammapada gives the three instructions, you know, number one, don't do bad things. Number two, do good things. Number three, purify your mind. So it's just one, two, three. Here are three instructions. But the way that Dogen says it is avoiding wrong actions and sincerely doing every kind of good ones has the effect of clarifying the mind. And you can see how that would work. I mean, it's sort of classic karma, or it's cause and effect. To use the language from my childhood, you know, if you do good and avoid doing bad, you're going to have a clear conscience. You know, your mind won't be reeling around with worry about getting caught or feeling guilty or cleaning up the mess that you've made, you know. So you can see how that would work. You know, we all know people who have sort of headed down the wrong road at some point. You know, they've made questionable decisions that led to trouble, and then it was one thing after another, and it's really hard to turn it around. And the reverse is also true. You know, if you put some intention and some effort into leading a kind life or a life of ethical actions, generally that leads to those kind of actions being reinforced, and the habit energy in your mind helps you to continue doing the right thing in most situations. Dogen also says in that fascicle that doing the right thing is natural. He said doing the right thing is natural, and naturally it helps the mind remain balanced and clear. So that's a pretty optimistic point of view. Bird's Nest Roshi thinks it's difficult. He thinks, you know, somebody made us angry, somebody hurt us, and it's not hard to fall into spiteful or hurtful behavior. So, how do we do what few 80-year-olds can do, you know? How do we avoid evil? How do we do good? Well, there's a lot of ways. I can think of two very helpful things that we can do. One is have a sangha. Having a spiritual community of some sort. You know, we're all fallible humans, but if we hang around with good companions, you know, with people who are interested in these questions and who are looking into how to live a kind and ethical life, it's going to help us live according to the precepts, help us do it ourselves. So it's positioning yourself with a good group of folks. My eighth grade teacher, Sister Concetta, who I did not appreciate at the time at all, I don't think she appreciated me either. Because I didn't listen to her. But one time she was talking to us about how to behave, how to be good, essentially. And the thing that she said, she used to talk about avoiding the occasion of sin. And I would just, you know, roll my eyes and blow it off, but somehow I remembered that. And it wasn't until I was an adult and I was working with a really fun group of people, really smart, really good, you know, good workers, fun people. And what we liked to do after work was go out to the bars and drink. And that would lead to some kind of questionable behavior sometimes. And that was when I understood what she meant. You know, I would put a positive spin on it, and instead of saying avoiding the occasion of sin, maybe keep good companions, or, you know, leave when they put in their first order, or their second order, or their 14th order. So anyway, sangha. Think about who your sangha is. The other thing that we have that can help us is our core practice, which is zazen. My A friend and mentor of mine once told me that, you know, there's really only one Dharma talk, and it's tell a story and then encourage everybody to do Zazen. I think he was right. So mine all seem to follow that trajectory. But our core practice, Zazen meditation, and it's very simple. You know, sit down and straighten your spine and then stay right here. And of course, we all get hung up on things like, well, when I sit, my mind just races and I spend the whole time, you know, catching myself and coming back. And then we assign a meaning to that, which is, I'm doing a bad job of meditating. But those thoughts that come when we're sitting are natural. You know, it's natural. That's what we do. We're human beings. We generate thoughts. And when we return to the present moment after we notice that we've been off somewhere, that's our act of sincerely doing every kind of good. You know, it's the coming back over and over again to our original intention of being present that helps us clarify our mind. When we do Zazen, you might say, I think you can say that one of the things that we're doing is just offering ourselves. You know, we sit down on the cushion and we just offer ourselves. We sit down with the intention of cultivating a mind of clarity and offer that for whatever good it might do in the world. And we do it without an idea of gaining something. Because that's just another thought that takes us out of this present moment and into the future moment when I'm a way better person than I am right now, or a way wiser person, or whatever, whatever. It's just another way of taking off. So we do it without those gaining ideas, or at least returning back when we get to those gaining ideas. So catching ourselves when we have those thoughts is just a really excellent opportunity to return to the here and now. It's like when we're sewing a raksu. We have this practice of sewing these small versions of Buddha's robe. And with every stitch, when we're making them, we say to ourselves, taking refuge in Buddha, taking refuge in Buddha. And when we lose our concentration and our stitches, you know, like we end up sewing our raksu to our shirt or something like that. Not that that's ever happened. Is Busho here? I did it myself just about a week ago. But when we lose our concentration, you know, we have to tear out the last 10 or 15 minutes of sewing. And when that happened, my sewing teacher, Tomoe Katagiri, would say, all the more refuges in Buddha. That just means you get to take all that many more refuges in Buddha. Which would, you know, sort of be a Sister Concetta eye-rolling moment. But it's all, you know, but it's also true. It's just coming back, coming back, coming back. And any clarity that we develop from that habit of mind that we develop when we come back and come back and come back. Any clarity helps us when we get up again to see clearly what's going on, what needs to happen, what my part in it is, and how to go about doing it. And when we can do that, then we can simultaneously be the 3-year-old and the 80-year-old. So we can just be doing our best to enact that teaching. And that's what I want to say about Bird's Nest Roshi and Zazen. But while I have you here, I also want to say a few words about James Wellman. This is a picture of James. It's a picture of James. He was a longtime member of the Sangha. I think a lot of you know him, knew him. He died earlier this month, and we had his memorial service this week. And so I just wanted to say a couple of words about James, who was just a lovely person. He did a ton of work around here. Whenever I think of him, the first image that comes to mind is him out in the backyard mowing the lawn. He mowed our lawn all summer long, way into his 70s. And I found out later that he also, I said something to him about it, and he said, oh yeah, there's a lot of elderly people on my street. I like to mow their lawns too. He also did a lot of work taking care of this building, a ton of work taking care of this building. He put a lot of time and know-how and resources into it. He and I were the Doan and Doshi pair on Wednesday nights for a long time. So he was the person who was the timekeeper and the bell ringer, and I was the presiding priest. And at one point, I had to switch from Wednesday nights to Monday nights. And after that, every time he saw me, he would say, I miss you. I miss being your pair. And it would make me feel so good. Even though I knew he was like that with everybody, it didn't matter. It made me feel wonderful. The other thing that he did was he learned body work. And so he taught Alexander technique and other kinds of body work. And about 12 years ago, I was leading a one-day sitting, and he asked if he could come and say a few words about posture to the group and then help correct their posture. And I said, sure. So he started out by talking about posture, and he gave one of the most helpful meditation instructions I've ever gotten. So when you're sitting, you want to be sitting with your spine straight, right? So sit up with our spine straight. And then he said, get your spine into position. And then instead of relying on your muscles to hold you up, just relax your muscles and let your skeleton hold you up. And it's such a tiny thing, but it completely changed the way that I sat and helped me relax a lot more. So it's James's gift to me and also to you. And then he went around the room, and everyone who wanted, during the first sitting, he went around the room, and when he was behind you, if you put your hands in gassho, he would correct your sitting. So sometimes he'd pull somebody's shoulders back, or sometimes he would just put a finger right in the middle of their back, and it would just really help. So I'm going to miss him. He was a wonderful guy. So that is what I have to say about Bird's Nest and about James. Does anybody have any questions or things that they want to add? Stories they want to tell that lead into Zazen instruction? Or are we all already thinking about treats and coffee?
Rosemary, I think about doing good, and then I think about an agenda.
Your agenda or somebody
yeah.
else's is your agenda?
So it's hard to be good.
Well, does having the agenda, I would think it would help.
Well, if I do good because I want a person to do a certain thing for me, it's a trouble.
Oh,
okay. It usually happens like that.
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah. But still, you've done something good, right? Then later on, when you're standing there tapping your toe and going, wait a minute, why aren't you doing what I wanted? Maybe that's not so good. But in that moment, you did the right thing. And you can always, it sounds like you do catch yourself and go, why am I doing that? And that's that coming back.
And then there's karma. So I decide I'll do good. but it's bad.
What's bad? That you decided to do good.
That I do something and it's helpful.
Oh, it turns out bad. Yeah. Our intentions are really important there. But then also our practice behind the intentions. I mean, we all know people who with great intentions go around sowing chaos in the world, right? Yeah. But all we can do is try, right? And keep trying. And keep trying. Yes.
Spiritually, a metaphor that works for me is to think about the wake that I leave.
The wake that you leave.
Like a boat.
Like a boat, yeah.
Not the Irish wake.
No, Irish wakes are pretty good.
I'll have to work on that. But there's the turbulence that I think I create and the turbulence that others might experience. And, when I'm 80, I might be more consistent in following that, but it's something I'd like to think about.
Yeah. And if after your actions you turn around to look and see, you remember to turn around and look and see, oh, did I cause a big wake? Did I cause a lot of splashing? And was the person who was water skiing behind my boat take a tumble? That'll help you to be more careful next time.
So I have this feeling that there is a teaching to be... I'm sorry. I have this feeling that there is a teaching to be expounded on bird's nest soup, but it's not coming to me, so I'm going to leave it up to you.
On bird's nest... No, I don't know what... I think I've heard of bird's nest soup. What is it?
It's a Chinese delicacy where they boil a bird's nest, and I think it's the saliva of the bird or something that thickens the soup.
Huh. They boil it. It's an abandoned bird's nest, right?
We hope.
It's actually a very specific species of bird that nests in a cliff that is actually pretty hard to get to.
Ah.
I believe, of course, I'm pretty sure that they do it when the birds are done nesting. It's quite a task to climb the cliffs to get to those birds' nests. And there's guys that specialize in doing that. I think it's a kind of swallow. But yeah, they basically make the nests out of spit.
Huh.
And apparently it makes a good soup. They can do it.
Wow. I am like speechless. I think I'm going to go sit out in the tree for a little while. Yeah, that'll be my answer to that one. The oak tree in the garden. That's what you're supposed to say when. Anybody else?
When the first woman that talked about an agenda for doing good and you're hoping they'll do something for you reminds me that when I was growing up, I was one of the most important things I was taught was the golden rule. And the golden rule was do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was great. But later I realized there are other versions of it with negatives in different places. Don't do unto others as you would not have them do unto you.
Right.
But if you think about it, doing unto others to have them do something back, you may be doing the wrong thing for them. Because you want them to do something for you, so you think, oh, well, that's what I want them to do, so that's what they need from me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So things that seem pretty easy, simple, you've got to be careful about them.
Yeah, all of these rules sound really simple. I know sometimes I've thought, well, I don't know why they're so upset. That would have been fine with me, you know. So the golden rule is in play there. But still I get to, you know, puff myself up and be self-important and self-justifying when really what I did wasn't. wasn't so helpful, maybe. Yeah. And they say the golden rule is the one that transcends all religions and philosophies. And I think it's a good one. If you enact it with some clarity, right? That's what it all comes back to, having a clear mind. Okay. Oh, good. One more, Ben.
Another variation of that, more of a silly one, is do unto others before they do unto you.
Before they do unto you, yeah. Yeah. None of us have ever done that one, though, right? Okay. Thank you.
Rosemary, I think about doing good, and then I think about an agenda.
Your agenda or somebody else's? Your agenda.
So it's hard to do good.
Yeah. Well, does having the agenda, I would think it would help.
Well, if I do good because I want a person to do a certain
thing. Oh, I see.
I'm in trouble.
Oh, okay.
Usually happens like that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. But still, you've done something good, right? Then later on, when you're standing there tapping your toe and going, wait a minute, why aren't you doing what I wanted? Well, maybe that's not so good. But, you know, in that moment, you did the right thing. And you can always, it sounds like you do catch yourself and go, why am I doing this? And that's it, coming back. Mm-hmm. Why not? Yeah.
And then there's karma. So I decide I'll do good, but it's bad.
What's bad? That you decided to do good for the...
Oh, it
turns out bad. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, our intentions are really important there. But then also our practice behind the intentions. Because, I mean, we all know people who with great intentions go around sowing chaos in the world, right? Yeah. But all we can do is try, right? And keep trying. So, yeah. Yes.
Spiritually, a metaphor that works for me is to think about the wake that I leave.
The wake that you leave.
Like a boat.
Like a boat, yeah.
Not the Irish wake.
Not an Irish wake? Irish wakes are pretty good, too.
But there's the turbulence that I think I create and the turbulence that others might experience.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm 80, I might be more consistent in following that, but it's something I'd like to think about.
Yeah, yeah. And if after your actions you turn around to look and see, you remember to turn around and look and see, oh, did I cause a big wake? Did I cause a lot of splashing? And it was the person who was water skiing behind my boat take a tumble? That'll help you to be more careful next time, I think. Yeah, Chris.
So, I have this feeling that there is a teaching to be... I'm sorry. I have this feeling that there is a teaching to be expounded on bird's nest soup. But
birds.
It's not coming to me, so I'm going to leave it up to you.
On bird's nest... You know, I don't know what... I think I've heard of bird's nest soup. What is it?
It's a Chinese delicacy where they... boil a bird's nest, and I think it's the saliva of the bird or something that thickens the soup.
Huh. They boil it. It's an abandoned bird's nest, right?
It's actually a very specific species of bird that nests in a cliff that is actually pretty hard to get to.
Ah.
Of course, I'm pretty sure that they do it when the birds are done nesting. It's quite a task to climb the cliffs to get to the bird's nest. And there's guys that specialize in doing that. I think it's a kind of small yeah, they basically make the nests out of spit.
Huh.
And apparently it makes good scent thickener.
I am like speechless. I think I'm. I think I'm going to go sit out in the tree for a little while, I think. Yeah, that'll be my answer to that one. The oak tree in the garden. That's what you're supposed to say when... Anybody else? Yeah, Randy.
Yeah, when the first woman that talked about an agenda for doing good, they'll do something for you, reminds me that when I was growing up, one of the most important things I was taught was the golden rule. And the golden rule was do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was great. But later I realized there are other versions of it with negatives in different places. Don't do unto others as you would
have them
do unto you.
Right.
But if you think about it, doing unto others, to have them do something back, you may be doing the wrong thing for them. Because you want them to do something to you, so you think, oh, well, that's what I want them to do, so that's what they need from me.
Yeah.
So things that seem pretty easy, simple, are you've got to be careful about them.
Yeah, yeah, all of these rules sound really simple. I know sometimes I've thought, well, I don't know why they're so upset. That would have been fine with me, you know. So the golden rule is in play there. But still I get to, you know, puff myself up and be self-important and self-justifying when really what I did wasn't so helpful, maybe. Yeah. And they say the golden rule is the one that transcends all religions and philosophies. And I think it's a good one. If you enact it with some clarity, right? That's what it all comes back to, having a clear mind. Okay. Oh, wait, one more, Benton.
Another variation of that, more of a silly one, is do unto others before they do unto you.
Do unto others and before they do unto you, yeah. Yeah. None of us have ever done that one, though, right? So. Okay. Thank you.